Dr. Anna Usom is an award-winning Stanford and Yale-educated board-certified psychiatrist and executive coach. On the clinical faculty at Yale Medical School, Dr. Usom is the best-selling author of Fulfilled: How the Science of Spirituality Can Help You Live a Happier, More Meaningful Life. Having helped over 1,500 patients live happier, more meaningful lives, Dr. Usom is presently starting a spirituality and mental health center at Yale and making a feature-length documentary on the interface of mental health and spirituality. Dr. Usom has published over 150 academic articles, book chapters, scientific abstracts, and book reviews, and articles for the lay public on various topics in psychiatry. A frequent contributor to CNN, Fox News, ABC, and NBC, she has been a guest on countless national and international TV shows, radio programs, and podcasts. As a highly sought-after speaker, Dr. Usom gives keynotes for physicians and professionals all over the country and the world on topics related to thriving post-COVID, preventing burnout, improving mental health in the workplace, physicians as meaning makers, and resilience. For her physicians and executive clients, she conducts workshops to empower individuals to sharpen their intuition, enhance their capacity for empathy, and improve their ability to connect with others. She also offers workshops for the general public on cultivating authenticity and awakening self-compassion.
Welcome to the EPRC podcast. I am so excited to have the amazing Dr. Anna Usom with us here. As I mentioned in the bio, she's a certified psychiatrist, an executive coach, clinical faculty at Yale Medical School, a best-selling author. We'll get into all of it. There's just so much to talk about. So welcome, Anna. It's great to have you.
Thank you so much, Brynn. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Yeah, I can't wait. So just to start us off, I would love to hear just even your background and how you became interested in psychiatry and then also the science of spirituality, because sometimes people see them as kind of opposed, but your work really connects them both in a really beautiful way.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yes. So my interest in psychiatry was spurred during college. I was going to be a mathematician because I come from a long line of mathematicians in my family. And then I went to Stanford thinking that that's what I would do. I used to spend hours and hours doing math contest problems. That, you know, as a total nerd, I was on the math team. That was what made me so happy. But then I went to Stanford and so many of the TAs didn't speak English. So I found myself unable to understand a lot of the classes and my passion for math started dwindling. And at the same time, I discovered in one of my friend's rooms this book by Irvin Yalom, an existential psychiatrist. And I read this book and I was like, oh my God, this is the most interesting thing I've ever read. And it was the book Lying on the Couch. And it was like a fiction book, but really conceptualizing all of human dilemmas and starting to create this framework of how do we understand the issues that we as humans have and how we move through those issues. So it was his existential framework. And I was just so taken and at that moment decided, you know what, this is who I want to be. I want to be just like this person. I want to write about patients. I want to help patients in this way. So I wanted to be a psychiatrist and an author. And ultimately that was the path I chose. So that's kind of the short story of how it got there. And then spirituality entered my life many, many years later. If anyone had told me that I would be a spiritual person, like, you know, in college, I would have laughed. It was the furthest thing from my mind. But then I completed Yale Medical School, was almost done with my residency at NYU, and was thinking something is missing from my life, and I didn't know what it was. And here I was supposed to help people figure out what's missing in their life, and I couldn't solve my own dilemma of what was missing. And I just remember really interesting and unusual things starting to happen in my life. Like I decided to start looking somewhere that I never would look for answers before, and that was in a synagogue. And I remember there was a lecture on soulmates, and I had met someone I thought was my soulmate. He obviously didn't get the memo. He was not interested, but to me, like, you know, this was the person. And so I was really interested and obsessed with this idea of soulmates. And so I went to my synagogue and started listening to this lecture on souls and soulmates. And on the way back, I was sitting in the ice cream store and this psychic comes up to me and starts telling me, like, she asked, I have a message for you. Can I give you a message? And I was like, seem relatively harmless, a psychic with a child. So I'm like, sure, tell me your message. And so she sits down and starts telling me all these things that she knows about my life, including the name of the guy that I thought was the soulmate. It's all this weird stuff. And I was like, what? What is happening here? And I think at that moment, I just thought, wow, here I am, this doctor supposed to understand the mind and how the mind works. And then these weird things are happening that fall completely outside of my conception of how the world and the mind works. Like, what is this? And this got me started down this whole other, you know, path that I never, ever thought I would go down. And I had a dream shortly thereafter of a sign that said Kabbalah Revealed. And my mom had studied Kabbalah. And she'd sent me books on Kabbalah. So I thought it was a book on my shelf somewhere that I never read. And I went to my bookshelf. Nope. And then a few weeks later, I was walking down the street and I see the sign exactly for my dream, Kabbalah Revealed, and it was the New York Kabbalah Center. So I was like, oh, this is interesting. So then I went in and I'm like, well, that's weird. I had a dream about this, some sort of weird prophetic dream. So I'm going to take a class here. So then I signed up and that just opened me up to these ideas, you know, ideas like in science, what we see of this world is, you know, 100% reality. So it's an empirical world. If it is real, you can see it with your eyes, you can measure it, you can taste it, you can smell it, it's accessible to your senses. In Kabbalah, in the world of mysticism, what you see with your eyes and touch with your hands is only 1% of reality. 99% of reality is the unseen and unheard. And this was a novel concept. And this is, you know, where it began. And this got me started down this whole path, trying to understand and learn and eventually start to write books about it and really integrate it into my practice and eventually start this center. It's not yet a center, but we're hoping it will soon be a center at Yale, the Mental Health and Spirituality Center that I'm in the process of starting.
There's just so much there that I want to talk about. You brought so much in. I can't wait to talk about the center, especially. What an amazing endeavor. I know it's something you've been working on for a while and you've made like an original proposal and came back. So I really can't wait to hear about the center. But just the idea of like synchronicity, I love so much. And like this sort of when you're not able to have faith, when you pinpoint these like moments of like the universe saying yes, and like this is, you're on the right track. I just find that so beautiful, important. And also the idea, Kabbalah, when you're thinking about, what was it that we only can access 1% of, can you say that again? 1% of?
Yeah. In science, what you see with your eyes and can touch with your hands, that's 100% of reality. In Kabbalah, that's 1% of reality. Right. 99% is unseen and unheard. It's like this mystical world, the other side of the world of reality.
So cool. Yeah. It made me think of, cause I know you like combine science as well. And so it made me think of like dark energy and dark matter and how that makes up like 97% of the, so we don't understand 97% of our own universe too, but the like the faith that it takes and that sense of spirituality and connectedness that comes of that. So anyway, your story just meant so much to me because this spark, and then all of a sudden you're just going in all these different directions, but then all these different directions come to bring you back to that same idea of things being interconnected, which I love. I really wanted to add, do you want to talk maybe first about the center that you're working on and sort of where you're at right now, and are you still fundraising for it?
So the Yale Mental Health and Spirituality Center, it's not yet a center. Currently, it's a program. It's something that I'm presently building at Yale together with Dr. Christopher Pittenger. Dr. Pittenger is an OCD researcher and one of the endowed professors of the Department of Psychiatry. He did his PhD with Eric Hendel, the Nobel Prize winner in psychiatry at Columbia. And together we are working to bring spirituality and psychiatry together in many different ways through many different research collaborations as well as clinical collaborations as well as educational opportunities. So right now we are indeed in the fundraising portion. We have some funds committed, so we're waiting for those to come in. And it's just very exciting. We've identified the first three research projects that we're going to have. Eventually, we'd love to bring in an endowed chair who's going to specifically run this center. And we have many, many more initiatives, which I'm very happy to tell you about.
Oh, that's so exciting and something that's so incredibly needed as well. Does that include then, I know you like psychedelic research as well and how that can contribute to mental health and well-being?
Yes, and that's a great question. So Dr. Pittenger is also head of the psychedelics research program at Yale. And so there's going to be separate psychedelics research and also psychedelics research within our program. So the current psychedelics research at Yale, the majority of it is neurobiology-based, so very, very much based mechanistically, like how does the brain change and what are the mechanisms of how psychedelics, psilocybin, et cetera, affect PTSD, OCD, depression, anxiety, addiction, etc. Nobody at Yale presently is doing research on the spiritual, subjective, self-transcendent effects of psychedelics, and that's something that we're going to bring into our center. So of the top three research priorities, that is one of them that we are identifying, and that's we're moving forward with numerous projects in that regard.
Amazing work. Yeah, there's several EPRC members also working in that field and similar fields. Are there any people in particular you've been working with or that you've found it useful having dialogue with?
Yeah. I've talked to a lot of people who are our affiliate partners throughout. David Yaden at Johns Hopkins is amazing. So he's doing really, really incredible work. We also have Michael Ferguson, who is a specialist at Harvard in neurospirituality. He's amazing. So we're very excited to collaborate with him and then a number of other people.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. So have you found that your experience being an EPRC member has sort of helped sort of with the research and help like make connections? What would you say has been sort of the most valuable part of being a member of the EPRC?
Yeah, I've loved the EPRC. I love the mission of the EPRC. I think it's so important. I feel that is very collinear to the mission of the Mental Health and Spirituality Center. I love Daniel Ingram. I love what he's bringing into the world. I feel that this is his heart and his passion project and what he's devoted, you know, many, many years of his life to, and also has undergone his own personal journey through this. So I'm a huge supporter and I'm very excited to partner with the EPRC at Yale and otherwise. And we currently at Yale don't have any EPRC specific projects, but, you know, we are developing some with Dr. Al Powers. So we're in the process, you know, of the three projects that we have outlined as our top three priorities. One of them is with Dr. Al Powers. So Al Powers at Yale does this incredible research on schizophrenics. In schizophrenia, you have individuals receiving auditory, visual, perceptual, other hallucinations, you know, somatic hallucinations that they're unable to turn off and control. Those hallucinations can then wreak havoc on their mind, on their life, and it's often medication that helps to stop them and ground them back into reality. And so Al Powers is one of the key researchers at Yale studying schizophrenics and their perceptual difficulties. So as his control group in looking at these schizophrenics, he will have psychics and intuitives, which are individuals who also have hallucinations. They, for instance, can have visual hallucinations, but in contrast to schizophrenics, they know how to turn their hallucinations on and off. And so recently I've spoken to Dr. Powers about turning his research around a little bit if we can provide the funding. And that is, rather than the schizophrenics being the experimental group and the psychics mediums being the controls, for the psychics and mediums to actually be the group being studied. So for us to learn more about intuition and the nature in which we can receive intuitive information, such as our capacity for clairaudience, clairvoyance, clairsentience, claircognizance, the ways in which, you know, outside of the normal channels of communication, we can receive information about the world. So he was very excited about that, and we're in the process of, you know, some of the funding that right now is coming in is going to go to funding that research.
Oh, that's just so incredible and really connected. I did have a question, actually, because you mentioned the psychic and then the sort of the connections between psychosis and psychics and where, like, where you draw the line, which is what you're doing exactly. And also just how it shows how tuned in we can be to one another, too, and how we can sort of cultivate our awareness and understanding. And so that kind of also brings me to, so the first part then, yeah, sort of how do we draw the line between, you explained it quite succinctly and beautifully, but between psychosis and psychics, and then the value of meditation in sort of bringing about these sort of spiritual openings and feelings of connection and wider awareness.
Absolutely, yes. And that fine line between being psychic and being psychotic, that is a very interesting and important question. This is exactly going to be the question of the research study that I described, yeah. You know, because so many individuals are seeking to enhance their intuition or their capacity to receive guidance from the universe outside the normal channels of communication or perception. Mm-hmm. Everyone's looking to be more intuitive, right? And where, and first is the question of where does that guidance come from? Does it come from an external source? Does it come from God? Does it come from, you know, something outside of you? Or does it actually come from the deepest part of yourself, that you're opening yourself up to your own soul or to your higher self or whatever it is that you want to call it, to understand how you can receive intuitive messages? And people often will, you know, describe intuition as the voice of your soul or that still quiet voice that can only be heard when the shouting of your mind, the rational, you know, voice, or your emotions, the emotional voice, temporarily ceases. So it's still and quiet, and people are always, you know, using meditation and other forms of connecting to oneself in order to quiet their rationality and their emotions to better able to better be able to hear their intuition. So I think meditation is a very powerful way of doing that. And there are also people who, you know, by virtue of their own vulnerabilities and sensitivities through meditation, it can open up psychotic channels. Like it could open up so much external or like, you know, perceptual information coming in, emergent phenomenology, as Daniel would refer to it, that it's very difficult to turn off. And for individuals like that, the kind of research that Dr. Powers is going to be doing, this kind of research is hopefully what's going to teach people slowly how to be able to turn off those perceptions when they are unwanted and be able to turn them on when indeed they are useful and guiding.
That's so important. I really love how you say that too. It is such one of the main missions of the EPRC is, so it is amazing that through emergent practices like meditation and yoga and psychedelics, use of psychedelics, we can have these like openings which lead to these really beautiful, like a sense of interconnectedness and that understanding of soul. And at the same time, as you mentioned, they can also lead to psychotic episodes or what feel like that. And why it's so important, the work you're doing in these integrative holistic approaches to health and healing, so that we can harness the power of those type of emergent practices at the same time that we mitigate the possible sort of dangerous outcomes that arise from them. So do you see that part of your work too, is sort of being able to show the benefits while also trying to mitigate the negative effects?
Oh, 100%. Absolutely. I mean, I have had a lot of people come to me through meditative experiences gone awry. And so we bring them back, sometimes with meditation, sometimes with other grounding practices, or they have had psychedelics go awry. And then they come, you know, to me as a psychiatrist, what do I do? How do I get my, you know, my mind back? So that certainly happens. And I've had people who, just because of their own genetic propensity, have never meditated or done psychedelics. They come with having psychotic propensities, and then you can stabilize them and return them back to their life. So these can, I think the most important thing is that these conditions are treatable, whether it be something that is, you know, spurred by a drug, psychedelics, a stressor, or by your own genetic vulnerability and hitting a certain age where that just becomes expressed. These conditions are very treatable through numerous means. And this is something that, you know, I help my clients and patients to do, and also something I know the EPRC is very, very committed to in a beautiful way.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, and also, have you had your own like emergent experiences, both positive and or negative, and have they been part of like a kind of spiritual transformation for you, would you say?
Yes, Bryn, I have in my own life had a lot of my own experiences like that, whether it be through experiencing psychedelics or through meditation. I've gone to especially some Joe Dispenza experiences that have been very, very powerful and potent. And so, yeah, I, you know, really think it's important. And I've never been disoriented by those experiences. I think for me to access those experiences often takes a lot of effort and, like, you know, being in very deep meditation for prolonged periods of time, or for like a psychedelic to unlock that. I've never had the experience of it, you know, but I am generally a pretty intuitive person and, you know, will receive that kind of information when I'm speaking to clients and just in my everyday life. So it's something that I think we're all seeking to enhance and to optimize in our own life.
Oh, that's beautifully said. Yeah. And those, it's interesting. Sometimes you have those spontaneous openings, right? But I've sort of, same with me, where it's this, and you more meaning from this sort of effortful practice. Do you ever think about psychedelics as like a fast track to what you can achieve from years and years of meditation practice? And if so, is that kind of cheating, do you think? Do you think you lose the benefit of meditation that requires a sort of much longer practice? Or do you think they're both equally beneficial?
Yeah. I mean, I have no judgment about cheating, but I feel like in general, yes, it can get you there much faster, but because it's not something that you develop through like effortful practice of your brain in the meditative direction over time, it's also usually, not always, but usually the psychedelic experience isn't something that persists for people. But when they do have it, it's a very powerful glimpse into this other state of being and to another reality. And often that glimpse is so powerful, and because you can have a heart opening. So it enables you to feel, what would it be like if my heart was fully open, if I live in a world of unconditional love? And that glimpse into reality can be so powerful that afterwards you're like, okay, I don't know what that was, and I didn't earn that per se. Yes, I did open that with a drug or a powerful plant medicine. And yet it completely revolutionized my perspective, and my question is now, what practices can I do to get there? So it could be a very powerful motivator to open people up then to the path to make that something much more enduring. That being said, it also, because you get there much faster and much more abruptly, it could be a little bit more dangerous. You can, go into mania, you can become a little psychotic. So you have to be very careful. And if you have a vulnerability or predispositions, to make sure that you talk with a doctor or somebody who really knows what's happening prior to embarking on experiences like that.
Yeah, what would you ideally do then if like the healthcare system were set up in the way that you would love to see it set up, and someone was having an experience like that? What would the healthcare look like?
The first and most important thing is to screen really well. So if there is a personal history of either mania or psychosis, this person probably isn't the best candidate for a psychedelic drug. That's number one. And in a lot of studies, if you have a first degree relative, like a brother, a father, mother, or a child who's had psychosis or bipolar or manic episode, you're also not a good candidate for it. And I've had a lot of people actually come for evaluations and say, yeah, my mother has this, but I really feel like this could be an incredibly powerful tool for my transformation. What do I do? Is there a way that I could safely, go? And that's something that you have to evaluate on a case-by-case basis. So that's a much more complicated question. And especially as psychedelics are becoming growing in prominence, and people are seeing the positive, transformative, self-transcendent effects people are having from these medicines, more and more people who don't necessarily fit perfectly into the category of people who should be doing these drugs are going to want to do it, and will request evaluations, and will want, special dispensation of sorts. Like, is it possible? Can I try it? Can I do it carefully? Can I do it under the care of a psychiatrist? Yeah. Things like that. So that's number one. But what happens if someone doesn't know that they had a predisposition, and maybe they didn't even have a predisposition that they knew of at all? Maybe there wasn't a family history and they still get manic or they still get psychotic. So I think the first and foremost thing is to stabilize the person. And usually that's done depending on the nature of like the flare, with medication, with grounding practices, certainly in like ayahuasca ceremonies that has happened. And there's ways that you can reverse the medicine. There's all sorts of things that both the shaman as well as a practitioner in the Western medical world would do in order to ground people. And then I think that integrating these experiences is so important, especially if the result was not what you had expected, and the integration maybe this was very dangerous. Thank goodness you're okay. Please don't do this again.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it does show the importance of combining the clinical mainstream and alternative forms of healing too. Just so one can inform the other. And again, that sort of shows the power of empathy. All these different perspectives coming in, and what you talk a lot about too is like meditation, but also like compassion and service and meaning and purpose. So I was wondering if you wanted to talk too about this idea of meaning making in people's lives and how important that is to achieving a sense of happiness in life. So convoluted question, but.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that this is also, this is something that we're doing all the time, right? We are writing our own narratives. Yeah. And so we're narratologists. And what we ultimately are doing is writing and rewriting our narratives constantly. And one of the key questions is for us as human beings, what parts of our narratives no longer serve us, and how do we rewrite our narratives and let go of those parts that are, you know, not needed anymore in who we're becoming? How do we let go and release parts of our identity and create new parts of identity and essentially, you know, become, you know, our, like, these narratologists? And psychedelics are very interesting in that regard, as we're talking about psychedelics, because in addition to offering a novel biological mechanism for the treatment of many conditions that we currently just do not have medications to treat for a lot of people, they also offer this glimpse into the mystical, this glimpse into the spiritual self-transcendent realm. And in that process, having that experience, people are forced to rewrite their narratives. Mm-hmm. And it enables people to rethink who they are, to reconceptualize their identity. And it's a very powerful way of creating a new story for your life, essentially.
I love that. It also makes me think of your work with Kabbalah. And you had mentioned in a podcast some principles of it, and this idea of, like, changing yourself, and then there was going against your nature and soul correction. And I thought that was so interesting too. Like, does that inform, like, when you're helping a patient or just in your own practice, do those principles feed into what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you want to change your life, there's so many different things that you can do, right? One of them is going against your nature. Identify that which is most difficult for you to do, and do it precisely because it's most difficult. Because how do we grow as human beings? We do the most difficult thing. And usually we know what that is, but it's hard to do. And it's hard to sustain if we do it. But that is a sure way to change. And that's number one. And number two, this idea of soul correction, it's a Kabbalistic concept called tikkun. And it's this idea that we all come in with certain things to correct. It's kind of like this idea of Sigmund Freud's repetition compulsions. And it's those things that show up in our life again and again and again, often much to our chagrin and dismay, and despite our best efforts to change it. So you could know your soul correction by asking the question, what is the greatest pain point in my life? And when you know your greatest pain, that is where you need to look for your greatest light as well. That's what you've come into this world to correct. And that's part of your mission, part of your purpose. And in correcting that, you're going to overcome and do what you need to do in this world.
Interesting. So, yeah, I know that you're also working on a feature film. In the midst of being, you're also an author and a researcher and a psychiatrist. I don't know how you do it all, but can you tell us about the film you're working on right now?
Yes. So the film started a while ago, and now it's changed directions a little bit. And the question of the film was, how do we study and quantify those parts of the human experience that are difficult to study scientifically? And it was really things about our interconnectedness as human beings, these ideas of telepathy, of deep intuition. And it was inspired by this experience that I had with one of my patients when I was many years ago in Ukraine on a trip. And I received, I woke up in the middle of the night in a start. Something was really wrong, and I had no idea what was going on. And I checked my email. And 1 minute prior, one of my patients had emailed me that he was feeling suicidal. And the fact that I had awoken suddenly in a start and found this, I was able to call my patient and literally and figuratively talk him off the ledge. And this was so meaningful for both myself and my patient, because he knew I was far away. And, you know, my patient was okay. What if I hadn't woken up in a start? And to me, it was like, how did I, because I don't usually wake up in a start. That's not a typical thing. Checking email in the middle of the night is not a thing for me. But how did I know to do that 5,000 miles and 8 time zones away? And this idea that we're actually interconnected with the people dear to us, often in ways that are difficult to explain, but that these things happen. And, you know, twins will often have it. Mothers will have it with their children. So the movie asks questions to try to understand and study these parts of the human experiences. That was what the movie was before. Now we brought in filmmakers to finish it up, and we're actually also going into the nature of soul and why that's important, and what is the soul of medicine, what's the soul of psychiatry, and really also studying, you know, all facets of energy medicine, that we are particles and waves, and that, you know, bringing that to the forefront to understand the quantum physics aspects of this that we are able to understand.
That's so, so incredible. I'm just in love with all of that research. Have you always been interested in interconnection then? And would you say that spirituality is that Like, how would you define spirituality? Is it connected to a sense of interconnection?
Yeah. I mean, I define spirituality as a connection to something greater than oneself, which for some people could be God. For other people, it could be the universe, source. It could be a set of collective and transcendent values like hope, trust, love, perseverance, right? And it could be Mother Nature. So by that definition, you can actually have a lot of spiritual atheists, which could seem like a paradox or an oxymoron. But if it's about a connection to something greater, many individuals who don't believe in God have a very deep connection to something greater than themselves. And certainly our interconnectedness as human beings fits very well into that.
Beautiful. And also, we'll end off soon, but I wanted to bring in, too, the really important point you brought up about kind of fear about talking about these experiences in the world of academia and research. Because I know it is, there is a resistance to spirituality and a worry about people. Are you finding that? You said it didn't become an issue for you, but why do you think there is a resistance to spirituality and to fusing spirituality and medicine?
Yeah, it is really interesting because according to the Pew Research data, 90% of Americans do believe in God. So technically it shouldn't, you know, they're by far in the majority. And yet within science, and especially within certain professions of science like psychiatry, there's fewer believers. There's more individuals who are doubters. And science and spirituality are in many ways strange bedfellows because science is that which can be seen with your eyes, touched with your fingers, and, you know, empirical, quantifiable, subject to double-blind control trials. Spirituality, in contrast, is deeply personal, subjective, transcendent, very difficult to study and quantify in quite that way, which is why the science of spirituality is a paradox and why the two don't always go together. Yeah. But it's precisely because they're a paradox that I think makes it so important to integrate these two things, and they can give us very powerful information about different parts of the human experience in very complementary ways.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, you answered the question I was about to ask, which was like how your ideas and mission align with EPRC, which is, yeah, combining scientific, spiritual, and the clinical paradigms. And so you really explained the importance of integrating those so well. So maybe to end off, I'd love to ask sort of where you find the most joy in your work, and then B, sort of what you see as your sort of ultimate vision and what, yeah, again, sort of how you're bringing that about in the world.
Yeah, so the most joy in my work is definitely with the people, whether it be my clients and patients who usually are amazing world changers doing incredible things in this world to make the world a better place, and also my colleagues who are, whether with this mission of mine or other missions, who are doing amazing, amazing things in this world. I feel like what gives me the most joy in life is to be inspired by amazing people and by connections with such people. That's number one. And also, I mean, I'm here in Miami, so going to swim every day in the beautiful ocean, that also gives me great joy.
Yes.
As an aside.
Yes,
as an aside. And as far as what I see doing in the world, I think it's creating this center at Yale Mental Health and Spirituality, and perhaps centers similar to it at other top tier institutions around the country and around the world, and then creating mental health and spirituality infrastructures within cities, within communities, within countries, within micro cities to be able to make this accessible to the world.
That's absolutely fantastic. And we feel so lucky to have you as part of the EPRC and really want to help facilitate all of that. And again, thank you for being here and for sharing your story and your amazing work.
Thank you so much, Brynn. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Aww, thank you. Talk again soon.